This is the Reading Instruction Show. I'm your host, as always, Dr. Andy Johnson. Let's learn something today. Topic of today's podcast is what elephants can teach us about reading instruction. Now, here's a word, high school. Right now, your brain is connecting with things in your memory related to high school. Even though you may not be conscious of your doing so, it's connecting to your memories of events, people, episodes, circumstances, things, and places that you've experienced. Now, if you were to encounter the words high school band, a more specific set of memories and associations would begin to surface. And if you were to encounter high school sports, a different set of memories and associations would surface. However, these subset of memories would be connected to the initial high school memories in some way. The big idea here is that the things we encounter aren't just randomly thrown into long-term memory all higgly-piggly. No, the things are stored with or connected with related things. And when I say stored or connected, I'm referring to the neurons in your brain that form the three-dimensional dot-to-dot picture called neural networks. These connections are used to help recognize words during reading. These are the micro-predictions to which Ken Goodman was referring when he used the term psycholinguistic guessing game. When we encounter a word in text, we've usually already made unconscious connections to the word based on what came before the title, the context of the sentence, or the context of the text. Very rarely, if ever, do we encounter isolated words floating in space. They are always found in the context of a sentence, sign, product, or situation. Well, almost always. If you were to see the word elephant written on a piece of plywood floating in the middle of a lake in Grantsburg, Wisconsin, you'd have to rely solely on letters and letter patterns stored in long-term memory to recognize the word. But how often have you encountered the name of a large land mammal floating on a piece of plywood in the middle of the lake? To recognize this word, you most likely use some letter clues to match the word stored in your long-term memory. You may have also identified the word by sounding out each letter. However, you'd have to remember that PH makes the F sound. You'd have to sound out each letter sound and listen to the sounds as you put the parts together. You'd hear the word elephant as you sounded out each letter, and then you'd say, ah, the word is elephant. Or so they say. However, if you were to encounter the word elephant at a zoo or in the jungle, you'd be able to identify the word microseconds faster than you would on the floating piece of plywood. And why is this? Because elephants belong in zoos and jungle. Same word, different context. But to really understand how you came to recognize the word elephant on a floating piece of plywood, we need to understand what's going on inside your head. Now, the eyes tell us a little bit about your intracranial activity during reading. Now, if you were to see the word elephant written by itself in the middle of a paper, notice how your eyes move. Even though you knew what the word was, when you looked at elephant in isolation, your eyes most likely fixated on E-L-E, P-H, and N-T-S, L, F, N-S. And then back to the beginning of the word and reread it. Now let's put a little bit more information around the word. Let's put some context around the word elephant. Notice the difference in your eye movement when you see the same word in the context of a sentence. At the zoo, the elephant was next to the tiger. If you were to see this, your eye movement would be quite different. The information in your head would be directing your eyes. Your brain would say, stop wasting our time. We don't need to stop on every stinking word. We can fill in the blanks, for goodness sakes. In the sentence, you probably fixated on the words at, zoo, and the L in elephant before skipping to next and tig in tigers, and then zip back and forth a few words after tiger. Your eyes never actually stopped on the words the was to and the in that sentence at the zoo. The elephant was next to the tiger. Eye movement studies show that most readers skip 20 to 40% of the words on the page. Now let's look at this from a cognitive perspective. You have a file folder in your head related to elephants, not a literal file folder, rather a cognitive structure called a schema. Schema means thinking. It's a thought structure or an imaginary file folder in your head. All your elephant information is stored here. As you learn more about elephants, the imaginary file folder becomes larger. The things in your elephant file folder are also connected with things in other folders, like your jungle, mammal, and zoo folders. And things that are closely associated with elephants are stored closer in your file folder with lots of connections. These come to mind the quickest when activated by an encounter with similar words or things. Things that are vaguely associated with elephants are stored further away with very narrow neural pathways leading to them. These things may surface in time, but they would take a little bit more prompting to become activated. And activation here means that your brain becomes aware of them, often in the periphery of consciousness. You're not consciously aware of them. This means that once you realize that you're reading about elephants, a whole bunch of elephant things get activated. The result is that you need far fewer letter clues to recognize words. Yes, you also have a file folder for letter pattern things, along with grammar and word order things, syntactic information. But when you're recognizing words versus identifying words, elephant things are more important than the letter pattern and grammar things. Now, analogies and metaphors activating elephants. Analogies and metaphors are useful in helping us connect a new thing with a known thing. We're able to picture the known thing and then shoehorn the new thing right inside of it. And suddenly the new thing makes a bit of sense. And did you notice how I just used the shoehorn metaphor? Now picture a harp in a large indoor football stadium, like the stadium where the Minnesota Vikings play. Think of long-term memory as a multi-dimensional harp that fills up the entire Vikings football stadium. Harp strings here go off in all sorts of directions. Each harp string is connected to related harp strings. And when you pluck one string, the vibration moves outward to the connected harp strings. Now, connected strings that are closer to the initial pluck vibrate sooner and with stronger vibration than strings that are further away. For example, if you plucked a string on the 50-yard line that was connected to a string in the upper balcony, that vibration may eventually get there, but not as quickly and with a much weaker vibration than a connected string on the 49-yard line. and the strings not connected wouldn't vibrate at all. When reading, each encountered word is a small pluck on the strings. This activates other related strings, meaning that strings connected to the next word on the page have often been activated before you get there. This is part of the top-down flow of information that occurs during reading that was described in an earlier chapter. Thus, you've got all these good vibrations going on before you encounter a word. This is the social psycholinguistic guessing game described by Ken Goodman years ago. This does not prevent you from using letter clues or letter patterns stored in long-term memory. It just minimizes the need to do so. Now, replace the harp strings with a neural network and electrochemical signals zipping back and forth. And there you have it. The social psycholinguistic guessing game. Word possibilities are activated before the word is encountered. Semantic, syntactic, and phonological information are all used together to recognize words in the larger context of creating meaning. Now, this idea of things activating related things is known as spreading activation. This theory posits that semantic memory of facts and information, is organized by semantic distance or relatedness of the things. This, in turn, facilitates more efficient and effective processing of new information and faster responses for things like recognizing words or responding to saber-toothed tigers. And McClellan and Rummelhart's parallel processing model demonstrates that a person can take in and understand lots of different stimuli at the same time. For reading, this means you're using a lot of different information to create meaning with print, not just the code. Now, picture an elephant playing a harp in the middle of a football stadium. Just messing with you. Don't do that. But you would notice, if you had that sentence in front of you, the difference in your eye movement as you read that seemingly meaningless, nonsensical sentence. Your eyes most likely would have zipped over it at least 2 times. And all your strings related to harps, elephants, football stadiums, and reading would have been vibrating. But the song was out of tune. It wasn't making sense. And your brain knew this, and in a desperate attempt to tune it up or create meaning, it ran over that sentence a couple times. So, based on the elephant harp theory, I present 3 recommendations for emergent and struggling readers. Number 1, students need to read about familiar things. Learning to read is facilitated by reading about known things. Early readers and struggling older readers should be provided with books, characters, events, and language that are similar to their own. This enables them to focus on recognizing words. Also, they've got lots of connections to their vibrating harp strings. This provides a scaffold as their human brains try to make sense of the squiggly shapes on the page. 2, language experience activities should be used with emerging and struggling readers. Being able to read their own words that are used to describe familiar things or experiences facilitates word recognition. And more space in short-term memory can be devoted to word recognition, to creating meaning with print when they're not also struggling with meaning. And 3, the use of decodable text should be limited. Sentences like Nan and Pap sat in a pan just don't make sense. We ask emerging and struggling readers to make sense out of nonsense with these decodable texts. And notice how I said limited, not eliminated. Decodable texts can be a valuable tool, but the value of any tool is dependent on how it's used. Used in the context of lots of authentic reading material, decodable texts can sometimes be effective for some students to reinforce letter patterns and sounds in some situations. But the really big point of this podcast is this. It's the semantic connections that are most important, not the orthographic, graphemic, or phonemic connections. When you encounter the word elephant, you don't connect it with short E words. You don't activate words containing the ANT, ant, letter pattern, or words with silent PH blends. You connect it with elephant things, regardless of the letter sounds or patterns. Just hearing the word elephant brought some of the elephant things in your elephant schema to consciousness. Meaning that if elephant were followed by the words sock, trunk, swallow, you'd be able to identify the word trunk microseconds faster than the other non-related words. This is called priming. Priming looks at how something that comes before primes or impacts what follows. The very word elephant primed the pump so that I would be able to identify elephant words quicker and more efficiently. And I'll be looking at some of these research studies in another podcast. Now, I know what some of you are thinking at this point. You're thinking, how can we activate elephants if we don't know what we're reading? If we don't know we're reading about elephants? It just makes sense that decoding must precede meaning. You have to decode before you can activate anything. Now, what makes good science and what makes good sense are often two different things. If you relied on a single word recognition system, the phonological system, to read, you would indeed be correct. But you don't, and it isn't. When you start reading, there's usually a title or a picture related to what you'll be reading. People generally have some sense of what they'll be reading. And even if you don't, the very first time you encounter the word elephant, you may indeed need to use more letter clues than semantic clues, yes. But you already have a sense of syntax, sentence structure, and the nature of the text being read. This information is all used to some degree before you use letter clues. All this information is used along with letter clues to recognize words. And once your elephant schema kicks in, you're off to elephant land. Again, this does not mean that you ignore letter clues. It means that, and this does not mean that phonics is unimportant or that direct systematic instruction should not be used. It does mean, however, that if we can develop what the brain does naturally, students will learn to read faster and become better readers. This is the Reading Instruction Show. I've been your host, Dr. Andy Johnson.